saw was a rebuilding of an engine test stand and some activity at the launch pad.
A supposedly inactive North Korean missile facility appears to be back in business. This is Thursday, March 7th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Remember, join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the U.S. president said he would shrink the U.S. trade deficit with China. He'll have to keep on trying. The timeline for a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan is a major focus of a high-level negotiation with the Taliban. And Silicon Valley might soon be called Immigrant Valley. Multiple sources have reported that North Korea has restored part of a missile launch site it began to dismantle after pledging to do so at the Singapore summit with U.S. President Donald Trump last year. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, also concluded that North Korea is pursuing a rapid rebuilding. Joining us from CSIS is Lisa Collins, a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's part of the team that identified the photos that show the changes at the Tongchang-ri launch site. Lisa, thanks for being with us. When did you and your group identify these changes? What did you see?
So we identified them in imagery from March 2nd, and what we saw was a rebuilding of an engine test stand and some activity at the launch pad at the Sohae test facility.
And what did that mean to you?
I think what this means is that North Korea is preparing to use this facility again. Either that, or they're trying to send a message to the United States about restoring this facility because of what happened in the negotiations last week.
That was my next question. Is this, in your mind, a direct correlation and a direct reaction to what happened? And what are you thinking so far? Is it that they're going to test again, or is it that it's just sending a message?
I think it's primarily sending a message. It's difficult to tell just by this one imagery shot whether or not North Korea was rebuilding the facility beforehand or during the summit or even afterwards. I think what it probably is just a symbolic message to the U.S. government that the North Koreans are still, you know, working on their WMD program, and they won't give up what they have currently until there's significant economic relief in the form of sanctions relief.
And so far, the U.S. government, especially John Bolton, in a few TV appearances yesterday, said that's not going to be the case. In fact, it could go the other way, correct?
Correct, yes. Bolton did say that if North Korea doesn't start to show real significant signs of dismantling their nuclear weapons program, there could be an increase in sanctions from the United States.
Now, I'd like to know where this puts, number one, the United States, number two, North Korea, and number three, especially South Korea, because it was to the South Korean President Moon that Kim Jong-un promised to dismantle this facility. Is that correct?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly. I think if North Korea is sending a message with this rebuilding activity, it could be the stick that they're trying to use to build greater leverage. They have, of course, continued to talk nicely about President Trump and about the aftermath of the summit in their state media. So they could be using a stick and carrot sort of strategy to get what they want out of the United States. So depending on whether or not that really, produces results, we just don't know yet.
Now, the North Korean economy is not doing well. I've seen reports of famine rising its head again in North Korea, or maybe continuing to do that with all the money they're spending on their nuclear program. Is that correct?
Correct. North Korea has persistent problems with malnutrition and hunger and productivity in agriculture year to year. They have a hard time saving all of the harvest collected each year because of the weather and whatnot, and then because of state policies. But the North Korea economy is not doing very well right now. Some attribute that to sanctions pressure, and then some also attribute it to just the failed state policies on the economy.
What about South Korea? Does this put them in a bad position?
Yes, if the negotiations between the United States and North Korea fall apart completely after Hanoi, the South Koreans will be in a very difficult position. The current South Korean government led by Moon Jae-in. They have tried very hard to engage the North Koreans. President Moon has staked a lot of political capital on engagement with North Korea. And so if this turns out to be a failure, it's going to be a pretty tough political situation for him to face.
And what about Donald Trump in the U.S.? What position are they in right now?
Well, I think President Trump has also staked quite a bit of political capital on making the negotiations work with North Korea. I think he will probably let his working level officials like Special Representative Biegun and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo drive the negotiations forward a little bit in the next several months and then see what they can produce before he is willing to meet with the North Korean leader again. But it doesn't look like the personal relationship between Trump and Kim has fallen apart yet, so I expect negotiations to continue.
Is the world in a more dangerous place than it was a month ago?
I don't think that the North Korean problem is going away anytime soon, and unfortunately that threat continues. They continue to work on their ballistic missile programs and their nuclear weapons programs. They haven't signed any agreement to make them stop that activity, so that threat will continue. I don't think it will be heightened anymore unless North Korea starts conducting nuclear weapons tests and ballistic missiles tests again in the near future. But we don't know if that will happen sooner rather than later.
Where does China fit into this whole equation?
So China is always very important when we look at the North Korean problem. I think China going forward, it would be very interesting to see whether or not they turn the pressure screws on North Korea to further get North Korea to give more on the dismantlement of their nuclear weapons program, or whether or not the Chinese will turn back to the United States and blame the United States for the negotiations' failure. Again, this is a very complicated relationship between the U.S. and China because there's also trade negotiations going on between the two countries. But if we can continue to get China to enforce United Nations sanctions and keep pressure on North Korea, there may be hope that there may be a negotiated solution with the North Koreans in the future.
Lisa Collins is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Lisa, thank you so much.
Great, thank you.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. The death toll rises to 16 from last week's abandoned mine collapse in Indonesia as hope to find survivors fades. Former Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn has been released from a Tokyo prison after posting a nearly $9 million bail under heavy travel restrictions. A bomb and gun attack Wednesday in eastern Afghanistan killed at least 17 people, mostly employees of a local construction company. A senior official at the U.S. Department of Agriculture says trade negotiations between the U.S. and China are progressing well via video conference. Expanded coverage of these stories and more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. When he took office in 2017, President Donald Trump promised to shrink America's trade deficit, particularly with China. Looks like he'll have to try harder. Figures released from the Commerce Department on Wednesday suggest the U.S. posted an $891.2 billion merchandise trade deficit, the largest in the nation's 243-year history. In particular, the deficit with China reached $419 billion. That's a new record. Andy Green directs economic policy with the Center for American Progress. He spoke with our Doug Bernard.
Look, the reality is that the trade deficit is one indicator of a certain number of things going on in trade between the U.S. and the rest of the world, which means some of it has to do with how the U.S. economy is doing. Some of it has to do with how other parts of the world are doing economically in terms of their ability and willingness to buy our product. Some of it has to do with policies would be put in place that encourage or discourage that. And yet it's also important to remember that against this backdrop, it's not the only measure of how we're doing economically. There are other things like wages for working class workers.
So it's not nearly as simple as trade deficit down, good, trade deficit up, bad.
That's exactly right. The trade deficit is one indicator, And in this case, it shows that, as a relative matter, the U.S. economy, consumers are buying more stuff from abroad, and that overseas, consumers and businesses and whatnot are buying fewer things from the U.S. Some of that is a function of the value of the U.S. dollar. Some of that is a function of trade policies where, you know, trade wars have sparked reactions by foreign government, consumers and businesses and other barriers that reduce the export of U.S. products.
You're the economist, so help me understand. The expanding trade deficit with China,
yeah.
What are some of the reasons behind that? Why is this happening?
Well, it's happening for a number of reasons. The Chinese economy itself is slowing down, and the numbers, the economic numbers there have been soft. Growth has been going down from 6.5 to 6%, and there's a number of indicators that suggest that growth is even lower than that, particularly in many places. So, you know, China is not buying as much from the U.S. As in the past. Now, in addition, there's a trade war going on where tariff barriers have been erected in the U.S. and in China as well. That also means fewer U.S. products are being bought. And, you know, the thing is that tariff barriers are just, in many ways, a tax where if U.S. consumers want the product, they'll just pay a little bit more.
Andy Green of the Center for American Progress with VOA Asia's Doug Bernard. Happening now in Asia, asylum seekers who are allowed to leave Australian-run migrant camps in Pacific nations can get medical treatment, will be sent to a prison-like facility on a remote Australian island, according to the Prime Minister. Scott Morrison flew to tiny Christmas Island on an overnight flight to announce his government strategy aimed at preventing asylum seekers from reaching the Australian mainland. You're listening to VOA Asia. The U.S. State Department says high-level negotiations on peace in Afghanistan, led by U.S. Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad, are still going on with the Taliban in Doha, Qatar. The timeline for a withdrawal of U.S. troops is a major focus. During a trip to Iowa Monday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo referred to the ongoing U.S. talks with the Taliban terrorists, though they're not on the State Department's list of foreign terror groups. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more.
Amid deadly violence in Afghanistan, U.S. negotiators are seeing an agreement with the Taliban militant group to end 17 years of bloodshed. Speaking in Iowa Monday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told them he has a team on the ground right now trying to negotiate with the Taliban terrorists in Afghanistan, trying to find a way to achieve an Afghanistan that's not at war. Despite carrying out regular suicide bombings, killing civilians, Afghanistan's Taliban is not on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Experts say political expedience has kept them off the list, because labeling the Taliban as terrorists would make peace negotiations even more difficult. Asked if the Taliban are terrorists or if the secretary misspoke, Deputy Spokesperson Robert Palladino had this reply.
The secretary's words speak for themselves, and I'm not going to go beyond that. I would say we are very focused on bringing better results to what's going on in that part of the world, and that's where our focus currently is, and we'll stay focused on that.
Asked about concerns expressed by Afghan women about the Taliban's role in a possible future Afghan government and what it could mean for their rights, Palladino said the U.S. wants a better future for all Afghans.
Special Representative Khalilzad and his team are working to promote intra-Afghan talks through a national, unified, and inclusive Afghan negotiating team that includes opposition parties and representatives from civil society, particularly women and youth.
Pompeo told the Iowa students He hopes the peace talks with the Taliban will make enough progress so that he can travel in the next couple of weeks to move it along a little bit himself. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Coming up, California's Silicon Valley might soon be called Immigrant Valley. This is VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Indian and Pakistani soldiers shelled military outposts and villages along their highly militarized frontier in disputed Kashmir Wednesday. An outbreak of new violence despite stepped-up diplomatic efforts by the rival countries to ease tensions. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. Home to Apple, Facebook, and Google, Silicon Valley is an American economic powerhouse, producing technology companies with global influence. However, behind these influential American brands, scores of foreign women who play a critical role in the Valley's tech workforce. Ahead of International Women's Day, this coming Friday, March 8th, we have for you an encore presentation of Deanna Mitchell's report on the women trying to build the next generation of influential tech companies.
Pushpa et al. May not fit the stereotype of the typical Silicon Valley CEO. She's female, foreign-born, and a mother. Nevertheless, she's one of the many foreign-born women with thriving technology careers in Silicon Valley, where companies are increasingly relying on workers like her.
Silicon Valley is known for the entire world about like creating, building great products that millions of people, hundreds of millions of people use it.
Silicon Valley, the global center for high-tech innovation, could be renamed Immigrant Valley. It is fueled by foreign-born workers, many of whom are from humble roots. And having worked so hard to get here, many have ambitions beyond their day jobs.
Do you want to take this risk and move to a startup? Hey, you know what? I came here all the way. Let's risk it. That drives like everything.
In computer science jobs, people born outside the United States make up almost 70% of those in their prime working years. That's especially true for women. Nearly 80% of women in computer and math fields are foreign-born. Most are from India and China.
Countries like India and China, where women's roles are often very subservient. Silicon Valley offers a pathway out. Engineering, in particular, is a pathway towards economic sustainability.
Although the tech industry is still mostly male, more and more foreign-born women are finding success here and are rapidly promoted. Lingling Shi, born in China, saw studying technology as her ticket to success in the U.S.
Computer science, I mean, for most of us, feel like it's easier to apply green cards. It's not my main interest, I'll be honest.
Family life is one way that foreign-born women in tech are different than their American counterparts. Despite their demanding careers, they are almost twice as likely to be married and also much more likely to have children.
I think to Chinese families, the most important, they will never accept, no matter how successful, like my parents will not be happy, like, oh, you're a VP of engineering now, but you don't have a kid.
Women from India and China are under a set of cultural expectations and norms that they will have a family right away and they will excel in their careers. So these women are really kind of super women in terms of the tasks that they take on.
But that parental pressure also comes with perks.
Typically for Asian family, like parents will be here when the time you're about to deliver the baby, then they will be here for like half year, 1 year.
Support like that can make a real difference.
They will get to those leadership roles a lot more quickly than their American-born peers who don't have the support that they need.
They may not be household names or on the covers of business magazines yet, but these immigrants are likely to be the talent fueling the next wave of tech innovation. Deanna Mitchell for VOA News, San Jose, California.
Good. Here's a news alert from VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has proposed a joint project with China to use artificial rain to clean the air in his country, where an acute increase in pollution has caused alarm. Seoul has been struggling to tackle the rise in air pollution that experts have linked to China's massive industrial activity and emissions from South Korean cars. This is VOA Asia. An HIV-positive man in Great Britain has become the second known adult worldwide to be cleared of the AIDS virus. At a conference in Seattle, the UN agency leading the global effort to end AIDS said the agency is greatly encouraged by the possibility of an HIV-positive man being cured, but there is still a long way to go. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Scientists have been searching for a cure for HIV/AIDS for close to 40 years. The director of UNAIDS called the news that a man in London has been functionally cured of HIV a breakthrough. Stéphanie Dujarric, a spokesman for the UN Secretary General, made the announcement.
The breakthrough gives us great hope for the future, but also shows how far we are from the point of ending AIDS with science, as well as the absolute importance to continue to focus on HIV prevention and treatment efforts.
The London man is HIV-free after receiving a stem cell transplant from a donor with a rare genetic mutation that made him resistant to HIV. His cancer has also gone into remission. Professor Ravinda Gupta at University College London said the man is now off anti-AIDS medication.
We waited 16 months before stopping in the post-transplant period just to make sure that the cancer was in remission, the patient was well, and that the measures we had of the HIV reservoir in the body showed that there was very, very little virus there, if any at all.
Gupta hesitates to call it a cure, but this is the second patient to show no signs of the HIV virus after a similar stem cell transplant. The first was an American treated in Berlin 12 years ago. Dr. Rowena Johnston, director of research at AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, says this second success is significant.
We now have reason to believe that the Berlin patient was not a one-off case, meaning it is possible to nearly or maybe even completely eliminate HIV from the body of an infected person.
Just like the Berlin patient, Gupta says the British man who is being called the London patient also received stem cells from a donor with a rare mutated gene called CCR5.
If you transplant those cells into somebody who already has HIV, you may protect those new cells from infection.
Some 37 million people across the globe have HIV, but stem cell treatment is not a practical cure. First, a donor has to be tissue matched, plus the donor has to have the mutated gene. And then there's the procedure itself, which is painful and risky. Dr. Sarah Fidler is a professor for HIV medicine at Imperial College London. She says a bone marrow transplant would be too dangerous for patients who are healthy and taking a daily pill to treat HIV.
Having a bone marrow transplantation is a very complicated process. It requires an entire new set of cells to be taken into the person who's having the treatment. And that, again, is a process where whilst those cells are embedding, you're very at risk of getting infections and potentially dying.
Both patients were being treated for cancer and had no option but to try the risky procedure. Scientists will continue to search for other ways to cure HIV, but now they know it can be cured. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast to take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com, and we'd love to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John Ellison, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and the VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.